Do you find it harder than ever to keep your customer training material up to date? If so, you are not alone. That's exactly why LearnWorlds has become such a standout in customer education. It gives you the flexibility to build training that feels like your brand, not like a boxed-in LMS template. And honestly, the analytics are some of the best I've ever seen. You get real insight into engagement, progress, and ROI without having to become a full-time data analyst. You can also chat with AI to immediately discover anything you want to know about your learner's progress, course trends, or revenue insights. Just ask it questions and let it pull that data for you. The integrations are smooth, especially if you're running HubSpot or automations across your stack. And the platform is actually enjoyable to use for both admins and learners, which I know sounds wild for an LMS. But here's the thing I appreciate the most. Customer education teams consistently tell us that LearnWorlds helps them move faster without relinquishing control. It is learning that scales alongside your product and business. And if you need to even train employees or partners, you can do it within the same account. Just create a new school and you are good to go. The platform is very user-friendly, so you are not relying on devs for changes that you might need to make, which gives you so much autonomy and flexibility. So if you're ready to upgrade your academy experience or rethink how you deliver product education, check out learnworlds.com today. And enter the code CELAB15 for 15% off the first 6 months of your subscription. Welcome, everybody. It's Dave Darrington again. Welcome to CLAB, the Customer Education Laboratory, where we explore how to build customer education, scalable learning programs, and the whole thing. We love to experiment here at CLAB. We love to learn what are we going to do in the future? How are we changing with AI? And we're also, at the same time, trying to break through, and like we say, exterminate myths, bad advice. That's why today I have my friend, Kevin Lee. So, Kevin, welcome to the show. I'm glad to have you on today.
Thank you so much, Dave. Happy to be on today.
It's going to be fun. We've talked a lot over the last year, and I have to say I'm really appreciative of the things that you've done. I'm not going to, you know, steal my thunder here. Let's warm up. As always, I like to do the International Day Of. This is where we have our tradition of we look at the International Day Of today, pick a couple of them. Kevin, you pick one, and then we'll get into the discussion.
Yeah, well, one that I saw that really stuck out to me is National Next Box Week. So it has an entire week instead of a day. If you That's want cool. to, you know, have some pets that are birds, you could definitely be extra excited this week.
Yeah, well, I like that. It's a good low-tech option, right?
I know.
For today, what I'm trying to do is get back to challenging our status quo. We were working to reach our audience in learning. And specifically, Kevin, you and I have been working, you're currently at Atlassian, and we've been working a lot on trying to penetrate this business-to-business software world. And I think what we're trying to say here in this is we're not changing quickly enough in the real world. We're not bringing patterns of learning like social media, short-form video, this super fun content. And this is what I really want to get you talking about, because you've been an influencer and you bridge that gap into B2B and you've done some really cool stuff. So, Kevin, let's talk shop now and let's start off with your story.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. Well, I've been into content creation and social media for over 10 years now. It actually started when I was around, you know, in middle school, and I started this Instagram account called Cuber Memes. I essentially was just posting random joke photos of Rubik's Cube content, and it was something I was really into, Rubik's Cubing, at the time, and so I wanted just some type of platform to share more about it. I then transitioned from doing Instagram to YouTube, where I started a YouTube channel called Cube Encoded, and after around 400 videos and, 6 years, I was able to grow that YouTube channel to 200,000 subscribers and 50 million views. So through this experience, really fell in love with content creation, fell in love with social media, and just being able to connect with audiences online. You know, for me, my entire childhood growing up, I was constantly on social media and YouTube, and I always had so much you know, positive benefits from these creators being able to learn more about the world, being able to be entertained, and just be able to create connections with these people that I, in any other world, never would be able to even know existed. And so social media was really that connector for me, where I was able to, you know, create content that, you know, not only allowed people to learn and grow, but also just understand who I was as a person. And coming into Atlassian, this is where I really wanted to let this content creation grow and continue making an impact through that medium.
Yeah, right. Well, how was it that, so you said you started to make your own memes and stuff. How did you get to the point where you could call yourself a quote unquote influencer? Like, where did that come out of?
Yeah, well, you know, it started with just a couple of random photos and going out there, and all of a sudden these memes started getting hundreds of likes, and I eventually was able to grow that to around 10,000 followers. So even just from that account alone, I was able to have at least somewhat of an audience, and people, you know, knew the channel or knew the page and had that, you know, I guess surface level connection. I showed my face some from time to time, so people knew what I looked like and that I was a human being behind the page. But once I transitioned to YouTube, where I was talking to people, you know, right in front of the camera, and it was much more interactive, much more engaging, that's really when it became more of an influencer style type of relationship. Now, I will say, I don't really like the word influencer at times, just because it kind of makes it feel like, oh, I'm out here influencing and, you know, having people under my lead. I instead see it as just content creation and producing really strong content that people love watching. And so rather than influencer style, it's more so like social content, you know, social style content, that bonds with people and connects with people.
Yeah. So you started creating that content, and it was around, well, the things that you were talking about were around Rubik's Cube. And I know you do competitions or have done them. And tell me about how you cracked that nut, because you got quite a lot of followers when you were doing all that. And then I saw some of the content, like, this is really good. This is, it's fun. It's relatable. What's your record right now for the different levels of cubes, I'd say?
Yeah, the Rubik's Cube goes from 2x2 all the way up to 7x7. But with the 3x3, which is the most popular one, I average around 9 seconds, and my best time is 4.8 seconds. So nowadays, people are getting very, very fast. And so that is by no means competitive in the national level, but I used to be good.
You used to be good. Yeah, it's kind of like me saying I was good at gaming back in the day. Okay, so that established, between all of your social media accounts, you established a following and you went to university. But tell me more about this content creator. You're still doing something about building a brand for yourself in style and being able to reach an audience who will follow you. I watch your stuff on TikTok, and I've seen it on LinkedIn. Tell me more about, like, how you get into the space, what it took to build and establish a, would you call it a brand? What do you call it around your identity of your content?
Yeah, I'd love to call it a personal brand. And for me, the way that I've approached content creation following Cube Encoded was to make the content more centered around my life. And so rather than making Rubik's Cube style content and make it subject adjacent, rather switch over to lifestyle content. And, you know, a lot of my life is work as well. And so work does get a fair bit of exposure within my content as well. And so, you know, I have just been loving content creation my entire life, and so I didn't want to quit. And that's really where the inspiration for putting together, you know, like LinkedIn posts and TikTok is. However, what I also realized is that being able to have eyes on you as you're going through your corporate life is an amazing, almost an embracing umbrella, and allows you to see opportunities that you otherwise never would have been able to. And it also allows you to establish yourself as really a thought leader in the space. You know, you see people all the time who come from these big companies and are really strong at their job. However, no one really knows besides maybe their team or the people that they directly work with. However, if you're strong at your job and you're able to have a following, not only do the people that directly work with you know that, you know, you're able to create very great marketing content or that you're a strong engineer, but those thousands of people online are also able to know that same information. And so for me, like, I found it to be very fruitful. On TikTok, I have several thousand followers where I post, you know, just everyday work vlogs and also share advice for people that maybe are early into their career or in college looking to learn a little bit more. I find that to be very fulfilling. And then also on LinkedIn is the fun one. I've been able to grow around 8,000 followers in the last year just through LinkedIn alone. And it was just by posting, you know, once every single day, put something out there. And yeah, I realized people just slowly started to catch on, and it had really two effects. One, it gives me opportunities to, you know, speak at webinars or chat with companies, visit different offices and connect with other professionals in the space. But two, it also allows me to get a lot of eyeballs on the things that I'm constantly doing at work. We'll talk a little bit more about Alaskan Answered, but because I had that following, I was able to do one post about the video series launch, and that post got 400,000 views within the first 2 days. And so you could really create a lot of traction organically through what's called EGC, having employee generated content on your own platforms.
I like that. That's a term, EGC, that I've heard it, but I haven't heard too many people talk about it. And I don't know if we use that enough, right? One of the things that I was really interested about your content was that you've really this is one of your mantras, I think, is to simplify that corporate jargon, right? Where I want you to talk more about this, where here we are at Atlassian, there's some really complicated stuff. And some of it's not. If you get rid of all the language that we tend to use around B2B, you know, blah, 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 and this shorthand, what our customers don't know or new people don't know. Tell me more about that whole simplicity action. And then let's kind of like break that open a little bit.
Yeah, of course. Well, during college, I was, you know, very interested in the tech industry. And so I was always looking to learn about different companies and what they did. And what I realized is that a lot of these companies just made absolutely no sense to me as a college student. You know, I would read certain models or certain piece of text, and it says the go-to-market platform to supercharge your productivity. Those are already three words that I don't really know intrinsically mean. And so because of that, a lot of those messages and, you know, marketing messages or brand messages really just flew over my head. And I realized that a lot of these companies, they kind of expect you to have this existing threshold of knowledge before even reading a top funnel marketing asset. So coming into Atlassian, this is really where the issue I saw was, where I would see different descriptions about, you know, our products, Jira or Confluence. And while they would be accurate technically, it wouldn't make sense to a lot of the people that, you know, actually read the copy. For example, when I first got my Atlassian internship, I was telling my parents about the company and trying to explain what they did. I sent them the website. I showed them the social medias. And after they looked at the website and the social medias, because they don't work in tech and they come from, you know, they're immigrants as well, they just had no idea what the company even did. And so I had to sat them down and explain for like 5 to 10 minutes what my company that I was going to be working at actually did. And I realized that there was just this huge broader audience that could potentially be users or customers, but because they never even have that first line understanding of what the company does, they have no interest at all. And so this is an issue that I really sought out to solve through the series Atlassian Answered.
That is a good buildup. And I'll bring into scope of that as well some of the work you've done with outreach to universities and college students. What I found going from B2B to B2B to B2B company is exactly what you're saying. If I can't boil it down and give a 10-second or 15-second elevator pitch, we got a problem because they're missing all of that background information. So marketing goes over your head. But some of the things I've seen you build were this content that's, oh, I'm like that person. Or, I understand that role. And then you're bridging the gap with real examples and good content. I like one of the things that you said about math, right? Tell me more about that. Like, corporate jargon is like what, geometry?
Yeah, of course. Well, you know, if we're talking mathematically, right, you never there's always steps to the different math levels that you take all throughout high school and going into college, where right. you start out algebra, then you go into geometry, then trigonometry, then calculus. But a lot of the time, these companies are expecting you to learn calculus when you only know geometry. And so they essentially use a bunch of different acronyms or terms that you'd have no idea what they mean. And without filling you in on those terms, they're expecting you to understand the entire sentence as is. So that's kind of how I see corporate jargon. They expect you to learn calculus right in that moment when you're still at an earlier math level like geometry. And that's essentially the issue that I wanted to solve with Atlassian Answered, where instead of explaining at a very technical or high level, we instead, to a degree, like dumb it down so that we first understand the lowest common denominator. Try to find something that's relatable. A lot of my background when it comes to customer education actually comes from my YouTube channel, because essentially what I did was teach kids how to solve Rubik's Cubes. Like I would teach, a 10-year-old how to solve a Rubik's Cube from start to finish. And what I realized is that in order to do that, I need to understand first what they know and then build upon that existing knowledge so that I could eventually get to the place that I wanted them to get to. So I would use things like metaphors or patterns. I would say, hey, this is a fish pattern. Once you find the fish pattern, then you have to do the like shovel move. Once you have those type of analogies, it makes it a lot easier to understand. And then translating that now to software, it is being able to explain, the software products through existing knowledge. So for example, let's say with Jira. Jira is a project management tool that supercharges enterprise teams of all sizes, of all types. Now, that by itself has a bunch of different buzzwords and jargon. And while if you work in the industry, it makes a lot of sense. If you don't work in the industry, it may not intrinsically click with you. And so instead, the way that I've tried to explain Jira is to first try to think about something that someone relates to. So let's say that you've maybe worked on a group project before in class. Well, if you worked on a group project, right. you've probably run into some of the issues, such as you don't know what people are working on, and you also don't know how much progress you're making. And so because you've been through these big issues, you understand that projects are sometimes very chaotic. And now if you extrapolate that from a class project to a 10,000 person company, you can only imagine how complicated now projects can get, where no one knows who's doing what and what you're working on. And so that's why companies use project management tools. And the most popular project management tool is Jira. That was an explanation that after a lot of testing really clicked with all type of audiences. And then the next step was, how do I package this message in a way where people can get a lot of visibility on it? And also people are going to be looking for it. And so doing a bit of an analysis, I realized that, if someone's trying to learn about Jira, a lot of the times they go on YouTube. And the reason for that was because if you just search up what is Jira on YouTube and you go to the top videos, some of these videos have millions and millions of views. But the thing that's most interesting to me, at least, is that these videos aren't made by Atlassian themselves. Nope. They're actually made by independent content creators who just put this together as a topic. And so if we had a way to harness all this search traffic and all this interest in Jira on YouTube alone, and instead have our own video where we could package in a way that we want to package it in, and we're able to direct audiences towards the areas that we want to direct them, we could effectively get, hundreds of thousands of people driving through this funnel towards, things like Atlassian Learning and Atlassian product pages.
Right.
So this is essentially what we did, and it ended up doing very, very well.
Really, really well. I mean, we talked about 400,000 people, 400,000 views. What about the entirety of the program? How has that all worked out?
Yeah, well, the entirety of the program has gotten over 2 million impressions at this point, completely organically. And in terms of, actual wow. video views, we've gotten hundreds of thousands, once again, completely organic. And these are numbers that you really don't see in the software industry, because realistically, if a company puts together a YouTube video, people don't really watch those type of videos. They typically will watch things made by actual creators, not companies. And so being able to get these numbers, once again, completely organically, when a lot of times, a lot of these views are driven through paid advertisements was really impressive. And, you know, we were able to, from this series, be able to pitch to CMO, get things like more funding. And it was just very clear that once we started putting out the content, a lot of buy-in was coming in from all around the company, just because they saw that it worked. They saw that people were watching, they saw that it was making sense, and that we were driving people towards the places that we wanted to drive people towards.
Right. If you look at other B2B companies, what is it that's out there right now that, okay, take your Atlassian answer, compare it against something else? I know what I've seen, and it's kind of me too kind of content. Oh, we can make this, but it just doesn't land. Or it was like they picked somebody out of marketing and said, go do this video. And there isn't a connection or a through line to the products. I want to give an example of a podcast. So I've seen a lot of companies try to do their own podcast. And then it's like, well, this doesn't really land, or this doesn't really hit with me. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I totally know what you mean. And it's because a lot of the time, the teams put together content with the assumption that people are just going to watch. They don't go create the content thinking that you need to earn viewership and that you need to earn attention. And for me, being a content creator on YouTube and having a personal channel, that was really the biggest challenge that I had to have for 10 years that I had to figure out how to solve. How do I earn people's attention as a 15-year-old in my bedroom putting together random videos? How do I earn people to spend their time sitting down and actually watching the content? So I think there's a few different steps that I think that any company could make when they're thinking about how to put together effective content. One, they have to think about if there's an existing audience. They have to think about, what type of people are we trying to reach? Who is going to want to watch this? Who is this relevant towards? But then most importantly, even if there is an audience that's relevant to it, if they see the video, will they actually want to click on it? And if they actually click on the video, will they want to continue watching? Being able to take those fundamentals from, typical social media content creation that independent creators have to make every single day is going to be the most important step. Then, once you figure out what your audience is, it's all about understanding how you're going to build the content. And this actually goes two sides. There's two mistakes that you can make in this situation. One is that you put too little thought into building the content, where you're maybe just recording a demo with a voiceover, adding a bit of music and calling it a day. That's not going to be strong content. That's not going to retain people. But then on the flip side, you can make the opposite mistake, where you spend way too much time worrying about every single individual shot, what exact music track you're going to use, every single edit. You spend months and months and months on a 3-minute video, and when it ends up performing even above average, because you spend so much time and investment, it doesn't feel worth it anymore. What you want to do is get that in between, where yes, you understand the audience, you understand that people want to watch, and then you get a camera, you start shooting, you put it together, make sure that it's entertaining, make sure that it is valuable, and then just put it out there. And then even if your first video isn't perfect, at least it's out there, and now you're able to learn from it. And so from there, you can keep on making more content and iterating. Something that I did with YouTube, at least, was the 1% rule, where every single time I made a video, I wanted to make the next one 1% better, which is why when you look at the first few videos of my YouTube channel, they're horrible. But then if you look at the 200th video versus the 400th video, it gets quite a bit better, to the point where it's actually a pretty solid piece of content. So I think that same mindset can be used by companies. But once again, the issue is that if you spend 3 months making one video, if you get 1% better to the next, that rate of improvement is so slow compared if you're constantly shipping out content.
Okay. This, I think, lands really well, because years ago, we put something together called the Customer Education Manifesto. And the point behind that was we really wanted everybody to understand that if you're not shipping content constantly, you have no opportunity to iterate upon it. Plus, people are wanting to learn. Where do they go? YouTube, whatever. They go out, do a search, and they find some content. That might not be our content, right? And so we have in B2B, what I'm seeing and what you're doing naturally is fighting back. I'm going to have an instructional design team, and they're going to go out and make a video, and they're going to lament over all of the font and all that kind of stuff. Whereas you get online and okay, I know how to basically frame myself in the camera. I know what, third rule of thirds. I know, some of these other things. And then you go. And then intuitively, you start picking up on, oh, that video didn't land well. Why? Well, I see a drop in engagement here and here compared to these videos, and I know which ones worked and which ones didn't. I'm not doing that again. And then you might try to experiment, but you can micro that, like little bits and tweaks and tweak to the point where now you're shipping content all the time that people want to see. And the main connection I want to make here is that I do not think that a lot of businesses have developed the comfort level. That's probably the best one, because you want to make everything perfect. So you're working on the rule of 1%. They're working on the, it's got to be 100% perfect before you ship it. And maybe the CEO has to sign off because it's going on social media. WTF, you know, we're never going to get anywhere. It's the same thing about shipping content internally. Have you ever had a challenge? Like, did something that you made for work didn't really land? Or I don't really want to say get you in trouble. I've had that before where I shipped some content, but have you had any real challenges as a part of that, or real obstacles or impediments at Atlassian or anywhere else?
Do you ever feel like your product team ships faster than you can build training? Yeah, me too. And that's why I've been checking out what the folks at LearnExperts are doing. Their AI platform called Leah takes your existing content, docs, slides, wikis, recordings, and turns it into full training programs, publishing in multiple modalities to nail blended learning for your customers 85% faster than traditional methods. And get this, when your product updates, Leah can update the content faster by automatically incorporating it into your existing outline, content, and even your end-of-course tests or exams. LearnExpert shares that their customers are reporting 90% efficiency here. Now that's time back to actually focus on strategy, or let's be honest, to finally take a lunch break. Plus, it connects with platforms like Skilljar and others so that you can publish straight to your academy without missing a beat. Check it out at learnexperts.ai/CELab and see how you can keep your learning and test in release mode. LearnExperts, build like an expert, update like a pro.
Yeah, of course. I think that for me, a lot of the obstacles that I went through, luckily, was through a lot of my personal channels, because, you know, when I was putting together content, I luckily had put together, you know, 400 to 500 different videos. And so by the time I came to Atlassian, I pretty much had a process relatively figured out. There were obviously, you know, scripting things that I'm working with different PMMs on, and that was really the help that I really needed. However, I was always making tons of issues and mistakes when I was doing my personal YouTube channel. And I'll share some of them here just so that people are able to learn from my mistakes. One, make sure you always have a full watch through of the content before you put it out, which I know sounds very self-explanatory, but sometimes when you make that one final edit in the content that you think is just that one final edit you need to make, it ends up shifting the rest of the timeline, and then so it causes another issue. And so, but then sometimes you don't even end up checking through those. So make sure you watch the content. Two, good audio is far more important than good video. You could watch a video if it's, you know, low resolution, but the audio is very strong, but you can't really do the other way around. I've seen so many videos that have 4K video quality, but then the audio is super lacking and it just sounds very uncomfortable, and that creates a very uncomfortable viewing experience for the audience. So there's that. And then lastly, don't take people's attention spans for granted. I think a lot of the time people think, oh, they'll just sit down for, you know, 10 seconds while we put down a music intro and put a bunch of graphics on the screen. Or, hey, they're going to sit around for this 30-minute explanation of something that only needs to take 5 minutes. But the reality of the situation is that your audience is going to leave just like that if they feel that the content is no longer serving of value. There's a reason why short form content is so popular nowadays, where these videos are literally 10 to 60 seconds long, and that's what's doing really well nowadays. However, obviously, as customer education, you can't exactly get an entire lesson out in 10 seconds, but you still need to follow those same principles. So for me, every single Atlassian Answered video is around 3 to 4 minutes long. And the reason for that is because it's the perfect amount of time that you could get a message out there, but it doesn't go too long where you start repeating yourself or sharing things that may miss the mark. And on top of that, a lot of what I do is making sure that the video is cut so specifically so that there are no pauses. And this is really what I learned from doing YouTube. This no pause editing is incredibly important, where the talk track should feel like one continuous talking voice that never stops. And then you have, you know, music going on. Yes, you can maybe have some cuts or some pauses for dramatic effect, but for the most part, it should feel continuous. It should feel flowing. I like to think of content as water. Like, you should think of it as just a very smooth flowing water slide rather than a stair that you need to climb. And the audience should be able to feel that the experience of watching that content is so seamless, rather than having to feel like they're, you know, trudging up a gigantic ladder in order to get through the video.
Okay. Some of the things that just make me wince are, and I did it with a podcast. This is a podcast, but it's, hey, I'm Dave Darrington, and this is my role, and here's my background, and all this crap. And we're going to talk today about, okay, cut that all out, right? Because nobody cares. I am looking for, well, what is Evenger about? Or let's talk about some of the other things that I learned about when I was at Atlassian, where there's a whole ecosystem of really cool stuff, and nobody, you can't get past the surface because you've got all these, okay, like talk about JPD. And I had no idea what that was. And I would see us and our teams using it. And we're like, well, how do we explain this to the world? Because I just don't get it. And it took me probably a few months to really understand how we were using it. And then the light bulb came on. But you came along, did a video that was 3 minutes long. And I go, well, where was this when I needed it, Kevin? We didn't have it, right? I like that analogy to water. And what about within that, do you have other pacing things? Here's something that I contextualize as the Gilmore Girls effect. For a frame of reference, you know, it was a pretty popular TV show. But what I'm referring to is the cadence of talk, and it's flowing. The voice goes up and the voice goes down. And I'm always getting a dopamine fix because it's just exciting the entire time. And it's not overload either. How are you making these nuanced flows? Like, how are you putting yourself on screen? And how do you make sure that I don't get overloaded?
Of course, yeah. Well, it's through strong hosting first and foremost. You know, certain people have camera presence. Certain people have something that needs to be developed before they're ready to be in front of a camera. And luckily, since I've been in front of a ton of videos, I felt really comfortable having that presence. And so that's really the most important thing. And then secondly, it's the tone of which you talk. A lot of times, because we're making corporate content, we assume that we need to talk to the camera in the same way that we talk in a meeting or a pitch or a presentation in front of an audience. But in reality, a lot of the most effective content is done when the speaker just seems natural. It seems like they're just chatting with you at a coffee shop or over lunch. And when it comes to the editing, there are a bunch of different little editing tricks that you could, you know, play around with. I think sometimes people struggle with over-editing, where they're having all these crazy graphics and all these crazy animations. And those have a time and a place. However, that doesn't necessarily need to be the case if you're just trying to retain attention. What is really effective, though, is using cut-ins and cut-outs to specify certain points. So, for example, if I'm trying to emphasize a point, for example, I'll do a small crop into the content. And that by itself makes the audience feel that the content is still feeling fresh and new, and there's still consistent beats that are feeling different. Then when I'm trying to move on to a new topic, I do a crop out. And so that kind of signals to the audience that we're moving on to a new topic. And a lot of times, that's just really the small thing that you need to do. Crop in, crop out, make sure the audio is continuously flowing, make sure that there's music changes as well for different sections of the video. Those are the small things that make it feel more like an experience rather than just a talking head.
I like that crop in, crop out concept. I think I've naturally used this too in some stuff where you just lightly zoom in. It's not like you're replacing the page or doing a swipe or doing a, because I've seen a lot of people go crazy with that and go, that just looks so inauthentic and like you're trying too hard. Mm-hmm. Right? You're just subtly nudging the screen, basically. I don't even know what to call that psychologically, but it's just enough to trigger my attention and not enough to distract. The other thing I've been impressed with is that you've really like just used iMovie and tools that you had on hand to do so much of this work. And I'm not saying this in a pejorative fashion, but it's an unsophisticated technical setup using the things that we all have right here and not getting fancy. So would you say that don't overcomplicate things, keep it simple, keep it real?
Yeah, of course. The reason why YouTube and personal content creators was able to make such a huge splash, I mean, think about it, right? Over the last 10 years, these content creators were all independent. They essentially just had a camera, a microphone, some very, you know, rudimentary lighting setup. And these people were able to get millions of views, whereas, you know, these big publications and news outlets or even Hollywood would be spending millions of dollars for, you know, just 10 minutes of footage, for example. And even though people would watch, yes, they weren't connecting with the content to the degree that personal content creators were. And the reason why is because you can really see the person on the other side of the video. You could connect with them and you could feel that the video is in a way kind of handcrafted. It feels authentic, essentially. I think for me, at least, there are obviously different goals for different types of content that you're trying to make when it comes to a company, right? If you're trying to make a big commercial that's going on the Super Bowl, or if you're trying to make a, you know, a 60-second clip that's going to be posted all throughout paid ads and be seen by millions and millions of people, then yes, you will want to have that high production value. You will want to have that meticulous setup. You will want to be able to spend lots of money on graphics. But when it comes to customer education, when you're trying to teach someone something, a lot of time, you're just trying to connect with the audience. The audience should be able to see the person on the other side of the screen and want to learn from them. And a lot of times, being able to have that more, you know, basic setup is what's going to help that. So for me, putting together the content and making it feel, you know, simple and I guess relatively basic in a sense was really an intentional move. I explicitly did not want to use a film, like a very high quality film style camera. I didn't want to have these crazy graphics for every single cut or transition. I wanted to have, obviously, a high-quality footage, high-quality audio, but be able to still make the content feel handcrafted in a way that they're used to on watching other pieces of content. The other aspect that you also mentioned is that it really just helped me get content out there. I think a lot of creatives and a lot of content creators have what's called like analysis paralysis, where they think about all the equipment and getting everything out there, and you know their output just simply is not as high enough. Whereas if you just get your camera, put it together, shoot some content, edit it, it takes like a day, you could essentially ship out content multiple times a week. And that's really the mindset I think a lot of big companies can really try to adopt. There obviously are going to be very big walls that you want to protect yourself about in terms of keeping reputation. Like you don't want to spread misinformation. You don't want to obviously spread anything that might get the company in trouble or share things that are confidential. But other than those big mishaps, you really can't go wrong that much if you start putting together content. And so what I would recommend for teams of all types is to just figure out how you can ship quickly, figure out what you really need in order to put together content. And on top of that, what is the audience actually going to be paying attention to? Like, is the audience going to get more value from a very strong explanation or an interest in engaging personality from the speaker, or are they going to pay more attention to a very detailed but very small graphic that's on the, you know, lower right hand corner of the video? They're going to be paying more attention to having an effective speaker and actually have something to watch. And so focus on things that need to be focused on and focus on what the audience actually cares about.
Oh my gosh, I'm thinking of so many things now. Here's a rapid fire. What's your opinion about closed captioning and having words on the screen with your audiences? Do you do that consistently or does that matter as much?
Yeah, for me, I love having text on the screen, but specifically when I'm trying to make certain points. And so if I'm giving like a definition, for example, or if I'm trying to emphasize a sentence, that's when I'm going to switch to a text card. Obviously, they could always have closed captioning if they need it. And that's typically auto-generated with whatever, you know, content platform you use. However, I do think that switching things up and having those text cards is really important in emphasizing key terms.
Okay, then that's, again, a cognitive cue. Oh, that's important. Okay, here's another one. I'm kind of going off script a little bit, but we got into the meat of things that I really want to talk to you about. I know that you have the opportunity, you have access to a studio. This is an edge that I wanted you to talk about a little bit, and I hadn't thought to put it in our notes. Even with your very trimmed down stack of tech, when you get to the point where somebody says, Atlassian came along and said, hey, we've got a studio here in the SF office. How has that changed or has it changed your production style?
Yeah, well, you know, for me, going into the studio, it was obviously a great opportunity, but at the same time, I didn't want to think all of a sudden, oh, I have a studio, now the content's going to be good. Just because the footage looks pretty doesn't mean all of a sudden the content's going to be good. And so for me, I still put just as much focus into things like the script writing. And when I was in front of the camera, I tried making sure that I was still being that same authentic self so that the content could end up effective. I also think another thing, the only really big benefit that I got from the studio, honestly, was that I didn't have to set up my camera and like put up the softboxes myself, which to be fair does save a lot of time. Like I was trudging my softboxes from home to the office every single day to do the shoot.
You have like a whole softbox kit like I do?
Yeah. And it doesn't have wheels as well. And so I was holding it as I was, you know, walking down the streets of San Francisco. So that was helpful. However, I do think though that being able to have a backup is always going to be important. Like even if your company does have a specific shooting site or a studio, I think that you shouldn't let that be the only place that you could shoot content in. I think sometimes, you know, these studio spaces get people very comfortable and they now think, wow, well, I have a piece of content I need to shoot, but the studio is backed for the entire week. So now I can only shoot next week. No, you could shoot in some random corner of the office and the footage is going to turn out great. What really matters is, once again, the talent behind the camera being able to make sure that the framing is strong, the lighting is good, and then the talent in front of the camera making sure that you're engaging the audiences. A studio shouldn't be a crutch. It should be something that saves time.
Oh, that is well put, Kevin. Oh, my God. I've seen companies and teams in customer education go to great lengths. And I mentioned Camtasia because those guys have been doing customer ed for a long time. They've got a studio, but they have a very simple and really clean way of doing things. There was another company, I think Code 42 used to do a lot. They had a really great studio and talked to their team. Like, I'm just dreaming of that. I mean, want to have a studio for doing all the production, and it just really never worked out. One of the things I like to see you do too, when you're on your like LinkedIn or TikTok, is you'll go on location or you'll just be somewhere with a camera in front of you. Now I'm following you as a human being, but I'm still relating to you and other all these contents, and it makes it really fresh. Oh, this is good. I think I've gotten more than I bargained for with this discussion, Kevin, because those are the kind of things that I'd hoped you would start talking about, is that you're keeping it simple. You have a methodology. You're producing quickly. There's probably some other nuanced things. One of the things I really liked about your approach with the studio, though, was, yeah, you're not using it as a crutch, but you've also now got a central access point for people to come in all throughout the company or in San Francisco. And you could do these meetups with them and then take a photo shoot for a day and then have all that content to distribute out. So now it's just not you on camera. Now you're bringing the expertise in others. And that came out just so wonderful. And it was so authentic because they were comfortable. They were on camera. You made that space for them. So that is another thing that's a pro, I would say, that was really good.
Yeah, it was Ayatanga. She was a product manager, and she had done a lot of on-camera work before. So I was very lucky in that situation where she was comfortable. However, I will say though that being able to manage on-screen talent as well is a whole other, you know, set of skills where you have to make sure they feel as comfortable as possible. And I'd love to give some tips on that as well. Where, you know, if you have on-screen talent, the number one piece to keep in mind and to maintain is the speaker's morale. The second that a speaker feels as though they're coming off shaky on camera or that they're not a strong speaker, that's when everything starts to go into flames. And so you always need to use that positive reaffirmation rather than being more critical. And then in the sense of criticism, obviously they're not going to be speaking from the camera perfectly the first time, but instead of saying, hey, this you have to do differently, this, and that, these are all bad, fix it. You have to say, hey, this is great, but let's make this small change and I think it's going to be even better. This already puts in their mind that they're already, you know, a strong speaker, but then if they just change this, they're going to be perfect. And then as long as you keep on communicating with that same approach, you'll probably get really strong footage. And then finally, being able to communicate the nuances that will come in post-production to the speaker is incredibly important, in the sense that sometimes, for example, if you have a script, but they have to look up and down while reading, a lot of times they don't realize that in order to do the video cut, you need to look at the camera for at least 1 or 2 seconds so that you actually have a little bit of extra footage that you could play around with, rather than look down and then look at the camera right when you look at the camera, start filming, like start speaking. That's going to be very important, especially start working with on-screen talent.
Have you used teleprompters for that, any?
I haven't used teleprompters, but kind of going back to my very scrappy setup, sometimes I just straight up get my laptop and then open up Google Docs, zoom into Google Docs, and then hold it in front of the camera. And it works. It's, you know, I don't need to spend any extra money. And, you know, we got the job done. Once again, I think once people spend too much time thinking about all this equipment and all these resources that they need, when scrappy solutions can get the job done, and it's not going to make any intrinsic difference in how the content turns out. So why not make those solutions?
You know, what you got me thinking about too, is it not only does it not damage or impact your content and the quality of it, but it also, it invokes a logistic constraint on the kind of material that you can make, because that being scrappy is often a part of what we're doing in the first place as a business, right? And I guess the leave behind that I'm trying to make is in customer education, in digital customer success, scaled customer experience, we are there to connect with the customer and our partners and even our team members as fast as possible. So again, you're getting content that's relatable, high quality, something I actually want to watch. And that's more important. Again, the message is there's tips and tricks, but don't over-index, keep it simple, be scrappy, intentionally so. I want to get you talking now before we close out. I think we're going to wrap up here. But here's where I want to get you really talking to. All of the stuff you've said are great, because this is going to turn out to be a good direction for anybody out there that's like you and me who wants to experiment. I'll try to pull this out in the show notes. Where do you think we're going to go with this? What are the next things that you want to do? Or what are some things that you would recommend for our whole audience to experiment with and share information about how things are working?
Of course. Well, for me, the biggest next step beyond this video content now is figuring out how we can leverage this video content to not just have top level traction on social media, but then to translate that and put it all throughout the customer experience and increase lift all across the board. And so obviously, you know, people go from awareness and then consideration, and then they start using the product, and then they eventually churn. And throughout that, your customer journey, there are tons of different platforms and channels that they're going to have exposure to. For example, something like an onboarding email, or once they actually hop on the platform, sometimes there's a tutorial stage, or there's a help center, or even as they're about to churn, you know, when you're trying to get off a platform, then you have to go through a certain amount of steps. Those are all pages and channels that you could leverage as a way to, you know, one, obviously prevent people from churning, but then also encourage people to go through and deeper into that funnel so that they become long-term users. And for me, my hypothesis is that video is going to be one of the strongest ways to go about that. If you don't have a dedicated customer success manager, how do you enable people across an organization and in a way that's scalable, in a way that touches thousands of people? Well, a lot of times you're going to do it through video. You know, if you see text, that obviously is going to be able to translate some information, but it doesn't feel personal. It doesn't feel tailored to you. But now imagine, let's say that you are an Atlassian customer, and then all of a sudden you get a pop-up where it's a video of someone who looks friendly and they say, "Welcome to Jira." They walk you through the platform, they tell you what they could be used for, and then they share you tons of more video pieces of video content saying, hey, this is how you can use Jira as a product manager, as a marketing manager, as a developer, and you can choose exactly what role you are and you see explicitly how Jira is going to help you do your job better. Those are the type of opportunities that I see with social content, because not only does it work well on social, but it works well in terms of building that trust and building that trust deeper and deeper until you get into the platform. So, you know, that's what I'm going to be working on. I'd love to hear other people as well, if they have other proofs of concepts and things that are working well, because I generally feel like as things are getting more and more high tech, AI starts to push new heights and boundaries, things are just going to get more complicated. But what's going to help ground the entire industry is that people are able to still feel like they're able to keep up and still feel like it's personal at the same time. And I feel like video is going to be one of the biggest frontiers to do that.
I was even going to ask you a little bit about AI, and you led me down the right road. That there's other threads I would add to that, because I think there's a compulsion now or a drive behind us moving to, and I don't want this to sound negative in any way, you know, 11 labs Wellset Labs for audio. We've got Synthesia building avatars. I can make an avatar of you with your voice and your motion, and it looks really, it could represent you. Now we're seeing, and what I don't want to see is that's overutilized, because the real authentic, genuine social learning. I think I was on with a friend of mine, I'll mention Greg Rose, who's at Intellum. He and I were talking about how Intellum is reimagining things too with their platform. And you know, we'd used it there at Atlassian for a long time. And that authenticity is the most important. And the personalization is the most important. So what I saw you do actually, and it was your spark, and then how that lit a fire where your content showed up everywhere, right? It was in the onboarding guide, and it was in content that we have on Coursera, and it set really nicely. And this is where I wanted to bring in the other, you know, the learning content design team and the other more conventional, traditional learning motifs. But you're taking that content, and like you said, I'm hitting a vast audience. We're hitting a lot more people. We're building trust. And now they go, okay, well, I'm done. I want to get my credential or my certification. So now they're kind of using that, and they've built the trust, but now we have their attention. So it builds a natural flow channel. And I think that is the most important thing to me. I want to leave off here. I may come back to you in the future, Kevin, and see where your journey takes you. And I like what you said. For others out there that are experimenting with this, we want to hear from it. Kevin, is there any one place of all that you'd like to be connected with? Because you're on YouTube, TikTok, everything, right?
Yeah, LinkedIn's the main one right now. So connect with me, just Kevin Lee on LinkedIn. If you are having trouble finding it, because there's lots of Kevin Lees, you just search up Kevin Lee Atlassian, and I should be the only one. And, you know, shoot me a connect, tell me that you watch the podcast, and would love to, you know, just chat more about content creation, customer education, and figuring out how we could make this thing as good as possible. Because for me, my goal is to become one of the best at content creation, especially within this space, and always looking to learn from others.
This is great. Appreciate working with you. You've done some great stuff. I'm looking forward to what you and the Atlassian team come up with next. If you're not watching Kevin on all the socials, and particularly go out on YouTube and see Atlassian, just Google Atlassian Answers. It's all over the place. Anything else you'd like to say to the audience before we move out the door?
Yeah, no, appreciate it. Just keep on making good content, focus on the audience. And Dave, it was amazing working with you, and glad I was able to hop on the podcast.
Absolutely. Really always appreciate working with you, Kevin. You've got so much to share. With that in mind, audience, if you want to learn more, you know, we have our podcast website at customer.education, but we're out there everywhere. We want to connect with you. If you have some concepts or ideas and you want to get on the show, definitely reach out to me. There's a form on the customer education website. I'd be happy to talk with you. As always, special thanks to Alan Coda for our amazing theme music. And if this helps you out, please do us a favor. Get out there and give our show a like on Apple Podcasts. 5 stars always help. On all the places, Stitcher, Spotify, your podcatcher of choice. Finally, thank you for joining us. Get out there, educate, experiment, most importantly, and find your people. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you so much.